and sometimes find it a little challenging to give a talk in a day-long retreat like this, because there's many of you and we're together for a short time. So how to address you in such a way that is relevant, useful? You come here in different, some of you for the first time, some of you with many years of Dharma practice, and obviously in different places and with different areas of interest. And my intention, my wish, my hope is to respond to your interest, to what's alive for you, in such a way that hopefully can be helpful, that can be insightful, that can be liberating in some way. So that's what feels challenging. And I'll I'll speak for some time, but I'd like not to speak for too long, so as to leave time for some exploration together and some dialogue, to respond to questions you may have, things that may be standing out for you. Those things may be reflections that come out of what I say, or they may be things that are already engaging your interest. I've spoken this morning, referred quite a lot, certainly tried to guide our practice through the morning with this emphasis on what I've been calling a commitment to presence. The commitment that I, as I was saying, we showed by showing up, and the commitment that we can bring in each moment, and the commitment that we can see often, despite there being some idea of commitment, an abstract commitment, can be quite challenging to really inhabit, embody, demonstrate in any given moment. So I'd like to explore this theme a little bit. What it means to commit to presence. Well, many of you, as I say, have done quite a lot of this kind of practice, and yet I also know that many of you struggle with the commitment to presence in terms of maintaining a meditation practice. And it's interesting, I think, and I think it's important for us to be honest, to recognize that there's sometimes a gap between what we express as a love of this kind of thing. Oh, I find meditation very important. You know, I think of myself as a meditator. I would say meditation is wonderful, that it's supportive, that I find it helpful to meditate. I feel clearer, more energized, less reactive when I meditate. Which might then beg the question, well, why don't you do it then more? Right. So I assume by the laughter that strikes a chord in some way. No? Is it true that some of you would like to engage more with meditation than you actually do? Oh, yes, Lord, yeah. Yeah. So I think the first thing about that is to be honest with oneself, that there's a gap between the idea, I value meditation, and the way that gets demonstrated. And then to be curious about that gap, you know. Well, how come? How come I feel this is something really important, and then yet somehow, amidst the various this's and that's of my life, it gets lost. It's kind of painful, actually, if that's the case. You know, many people, the vast majority of people maybe, don't have a sense of what really feels most important and profound and beautiful in their lives. And so if we do have that sense, if we feel like we have the good fortune to be in touch with something that feels transformative, feels of immense depth and value in life, then it's quite sad if that somehow just gets lost among other things that in theory we might think are of a less important, but in actuality end up taking priority. And so one of my suggestions for that is to lower the bar, as it were, in terms of our expectations. There's nothing magical about 45 minutes as a length of time of meditation, but we tend to, it seems, like our tendency is to set the bar high and then consistently fail to meet it. Not for everyone. I know some of you are well established in a very committed and regular meditation practice. But for others, there's this gap and struggle. You know? And it's a shame to then, what we're engendering by setting the bar high, I should just sit for an hour in the morning, whatever it might be, and then not sitting at all. What we're engendering is a sense of failure and disappointment. We're engendering in ourselves consistently the sense of, oh, there's something that I would really like to do, that I feel I should do, that I know would be good for me to do, and I'm too tired to do it, or too busy to do it, or too this to do it, or too that to do it. I'm sure some of you have seen at a place in France, I'm not sure if it's still on the notice board actually, and some of you will have heard me talk about this cartoon that we had up. Firstly, of a small child playing on the floor. It said underneath, too young to meditate. And then was of some teenagers gazing at each other, too much in love to meditate. And of someone looking very busy at their desk, too busy to meditate. And someone exhausted at the end of the long day, too tired to meditate. And it went on and on like this. And the last picture is of a tombstone. It says, too late to meditate. The most important moment of meditation is the moment that you decide to sit down, or the moment that you actually sit down. The moment where you demonstrate to yourself the commitment to presence. I would say that moment is exponentially much, much more important than all the other moments that follow it. The sincerity that we can bring to our practice is exponentially more important than how much time we're sitting cross-legged for. So, set the bar low and consistently make it, which then engenders feeling a sense of confidence, of aligning oneself with what one finds most important in life. A sense of filling out into a sense of living my life in tune with what I really value. So we could bring the bar from 45 minutes to maybe 2 minutes. It's like, oh, I could probably do that. It might seem terrible thing for a meditation teacher to suggest, right? 2 minutes of meditation. But I have the suspicion that if you were to commit, really commit to sitting down for 2 minutes, you might find at the end of those 2 minutes that you had a little bit more time to spare. And you might stay there longer sometimes. Sometimes maybe not. No, how? And to try and illustrate this point of the moment that we actually turn towards presence as being the most significant moment. You know, imagine if you were to really practice kind of a diligent, bright, attentive awareness for 1 minute every hour. So if you're awake for 15 or 18 hours a day, that would be just a quarter of an hour in the whole day. Not much, right? Much, much less than we've been sitting for any one single period of meditation today. And yet that would be consistently every hour during the day a realignment, a checking, where am I? And what do I want to prioritize right now? And that would be transforming in a way that, you know, a sitting practice that may be longer but may also be quite mechanical can't be transformative. So, If you're committed to this practice, if you find that you sit once or twice a day for some long period, please don't feel the need now to change that to only 2 minutes. But I think it's also about finding a creative way in which we align ourselves with what feels important. And one can't underestimate the power of that. The sense that it engenders in our being when we feel like we're actually doing what we find important. When we're living inside what we find important, rather than idealizing it in an abstract way. So we might reflect in our lives, what might be really useful for me in committing to presence, in committing to being where I am, in committing to exploring consciousness, in committing to waking up to my own reactivity, to the way the momentum of having, doing, getting, becoming can kind of take things over. And because that momentum is there, it may be, especially if our practice feels kind of young or fragile in some way, it may be that the sense of sitting with that momentum, the inner momentum, for 40 minutes seems too much. Maybe it is too much. So rather than waiting around for some imaginary time when suddenly it won't be too much, and we'll suddenly be able to sit, go from 0 to 40, as it were, see, what can I commit to? What would really support me? And what would support me that's actually realistic and manageable, rather than just far off and idealistic? I think also in the translation of meditation practice, or in the translation of the practice of presence, we could say, from the rather formal, still refined version that is meditation, into the rather dynamic, engaged, impactful version that's called Living in London, for example. There's going to be some significant differences with how that is. When we come, the kind of beautiful stripping down of taking one simple object, breath, and committing to that in the way that we have been today, we may expect that somehow, when I'm in a more engaged and busy mode, we might expect the same quality of attention. We often try to do, one thing in that way, and then find ourselves, how do I manage this? How does that translate sitting quietly, walking one step at a time into, my multitasking life? I remember somebody I knew being on retreat with, I don't remember who, some teacher or other, and the teacher was giving a lot of emphasis to doing one thing at a time, to giving all one's attention to one thing. Sounds like another way of presenting that sense of commitment to presence. All one's attention to just what the thing you're doing. And then the person went in to see the teacher at some point, and the teacher had his feet up on the table and was reading book and eating his lunch. The student was aghast. You've been telling us to give all our attention just to one thing. And look at you. He said, yeah, I'm giving all my attention to eating lunch and reading my book. So that our sense of one thing can be quite broad and inclusive. That really our one thing is the immediacy of our participation in what we're doing. And there's an extraordinary value to stripping down that participation in what we're doing to its finest, simplest expression, sitting and breathing. Right. But if we have too much of a view of, oh, that's what this practice is, then we're kind of in trouble in all the moments of our lives that are participatory in a much broader, more impactful way. Sometimes our one thing needs to be very broad, you know. Driving while having a conversation and being, you know, noticing all that's going on around us. The various, whatever, you can fill in the gaps, you know, and fill in the dots for whatever the things are that constitute the busyness and the challenge. The challenges of your daily activities, relationships, duties, responsibilities. But in the midst of all that, were again worth reflecting, what would it mean to attend to just this? However much is included in the just this, what might be a broad enough, inclusive enough sense of just this that we can bring a sense of a whole participation, a wholehearted participation into it? Because in many ways, that's what this practice and the fruits of this practice are about. Including more and more and more of life in our sense of our participation in it. Often what feels most uncomfortable, most difficult, most conflicted in our life is the sense that not much seems included in it. Most of what seems included is all about me. My history, my problems, my issues, my difficulties, my relationships, my needs, my wants, my career, my. If our sense of one thing, the what the Buddha called the tatata, the suchness, the like thisness that's going on, can be broad enough, then the natural fruits of that are that more and more start to be included. What I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, what I'm experiencing, the person I'm interacting with, the feelings that are going on. The whole sense of participation starts to open out in such a way that, ah, there's more of life here. That life starts to change, from our sense of life starts to change from one of me and my this and my that negotiating with life, to a much more inclusive sense of participation in life, we could say intimacy with life, non-separation from life, wherein the one thing, the just this, includes what's here and what's there, what's within and what's without and what's around. Well, the commitment to presence isn't dependent on any particular conditions. It isn't dependent on silence or on sitting still or on some kind of spiritual context. So it's another opportunity to reflect. What might it mean? What might it mean to commit to presence in such a way that there's no situation that precludes that? Maybe challenges. But is there some way in which we've set up our inner life or spiritual practice or personal growth or whatever we might call it as being here, in this context, in this place, at this time, in this manner? And then we've got a whole bunch of the other bits of our life kind of separate from that, outside of that. And the reflection then, in what way might I commit to presence to participation in such a way that can bring those together. In such a way that can include whatever's here. There's something quite beautiful about that. If our real orientation toward waking up in life is including whatever's here, that means we don't have to go looking for stuff. We don't have to be aiming for somewhere else, aiming towards some kind of spiritual ideal for what should be or could be happening, for how I could be or should be feeling, for how I could be or should be behaving, measuring ourselves against some ideal, wherein unfortunately we always find ourselves lacking. So, maybe I can come back from that idealizing, from that reaching out, from that aiming for something far away, to including what's here. And I would say for myself, after 20 years of this kind of practice, that the sense of what that means to include what's here continues to deepen and open and reveal more and more of itself. Another way, slightly similar in some ways, in terms of this idealism, you know, we often want to practice, we want to commit to presence in such a way that we experience the fruits of spiritual promise, we could say, usually called in Buddhist tradition, called wisdom and compassion, called love and kindness and gentleness, peacefulness, all these kind of beautiful spiritual qualities. But sometimes that's not what we find, right? That's not what's here. Sometimes what's here is the other end of the equation. All the troublesome feelings and reactions and experiences that we come across. What in Buddhist shorthand is called greed, hatred and delusion. Those being, as I say, shorthand to cover the whole big pile of reactive, stressful, afflictive, difficult things, reactions. The struggle and difficult things that often we'd try to kind of hide away. Hide away sometimes from ourselves, denying that they're even there, or hide away from others, as if there's something kind of shameful about them. Something shameful about feeling greedy, hateful, or deluded, in Buddhist shorthand. Something shameful about feeling envious, jealous, confused, revengeful, etc., etc. So part of what we mean by committing to presence, to what's right here, is actually including those things. I think sometimes we need to hear less about wisdom and compassion and more about greed, hatred and delusion, as a way partly to normalize those things. Somebody mentioned this morning, you know, going into the loo and finding a way to give vent to anger, to wanting to hit someone. And I was very, very pleased to hear that brought here. And I was also aware of a couple of gasps. You know, oh my goodness, wanting to hit someone, that's not very Buddhist. But there's something important, there's something healing about disclosure, right? And that might just be disclosure to ourselves, owning up to the fact that, this is greed, greedy feeling. This is aggressive feeling. This is revengeful feeling. This is irritable feeling. It's quite a relief to just acknowledge that that's there, rather than trying to hide it away, push it away, keep it down, as if it's something shameful. I've just been on retreat myself for a week in Wales. Very beautiful March in Wales. It was lovely and sunny like this. Lots of lambs and daffodils. It was like the quintessential picture of Wales, except that it wasn't raining. And just a couple of days ago, it must have been on Thursday, I think it was, I was waiting for my toast in the morning, breakfast. So it's often, you know, it's a practice of patience, waiting for toast, right? And it's a very clunky old toaster they have in this place. It seems to take a long time. So I find myself standing there, being very patient. Except I started to notice I was actually more acting very patient. You know? I was busier trying to look patient and equanimous and meditative than I was actually busy being patient. I wasn't being patient. So there's some movement. Oh, come on, I want my toast. Right? And immediately following the kind of surge of impatience, I want my toast, was a kind of, oh my goodness, a kind of dampening it down. In fact, it was a mixture of dampening it down in terms of not wanting to feel it or see it, because it contrasts with my self-image. I don't think of myself as that kind of, you know, toast maniac. I would prefer to think of myself as, you know, I just stand there waiting for toast. Right. So there was a mixture of trying not to want to experience that impatience myself, and also a mixture of, going along with that, of not wanting to appear like toast maniac to those around me. So what do we do? What do I do? We could, like we were saying with the one of the examples this morning, you know, could, what do I do? Do I just give myself over to that? Okay, I mustn't suppress it. Shaking the toaster, you know, popping it up every 2 seconds, you know, stamping up and down, I want my toast. Part of us would kind of, in some strange fantasy life, part of me then would like to have done that, you know, because there's quite, like I say, a surge of impatience. But it clearly wouldn't be supported for the others who were also on retreat. It clearly wouldn't really get me anywhere. It certainly wouldn't make my toast come faster. And it might have a certain kind of playfulness to it, but it didn't seem to be the wise option, right? But also, I'm committed to presence, to including what's here. It really doesn't seem the wise option either to suppress it through not wanting to experience the agitation of that impatience, nor does it seem particularly healthy to be so, you know, more concerned with how I'm being perceived by others than in terms of looking or feeling impatient than with what's going on. Rather, you know, these very beautiful, I think one of the most beautiful expressions of the Buddha's teachings is the emphasis on the middle way. And avoiding firstly, I think those teachings are about recognizing the tendency of our minds to go here or there. And what does it mean to avoid here and there? To avoid, in this case, the indulgence, the acting out, the expression of that impatience, and equally to avoid the putting it aside, pushing it down, trying to pretend to myself or to others that it's not really there and I'm fine and peaceful. And to commit to presence in that sense is to actually allow the surge, allow the movement, I want my toast! To actually allow myself to really feel that. Often, when we let ourselves feel something, we get more caught up with the object. We were talking this morning about letting go of content, right? More we get obsessed with the toast. But what's much more interesting, what's much more helpful, is not the sense of toast, but the feeling that goes with, I want my... It's like, wow, what's this? If I just feel the energy of impatience. I mention this because in response to a few questions this morning that had a similar feel to this, or a similar sense of that coming back from what it all seems to be about, toast. I mean, what actually happens? You know, impatience is quite a fantastic thing, actually, if we really let ourselves feel it. It feels like a scratchy, uncomfortable, sort of pulsing thing that I can't contain. And then therefore it feels like the only way to contain it is to get my bloody toast. And then I feel better for a moment. But what if I just let myself tolerate what seems, first of all, like an uncomfortable, scratchy, sort of exploding energy? When I get below the what it seems to be about, when I let myself stand there, rather than this ambivalent position of trying to be present or sort of pretending to be present in some way, imagining what it looks like to be present. You know, those of us who've been on retreat or even here, we might ask ourselves, how much time have I spent practicing presence, and how much have I spent trying to look present? You know, trying to look like what walking meditation should look like. Then, as I stand experiencing experiencing impatience, I find myself very, very present. Very present. It's very enlivening experiencing some strong movement within. And because it's a strong movement, once I let go of what it seems to be about, and the trying to push it down and away, it's extraordinarily enlivening, dynamic, energizing, bright. So what started as impatience to get my toast turned out to be some of the most enlivened, awake presence that I've ever noticed while waiting for toast. And I offer this rather kind of long and detailed description of standing by the toaster, because I'm in England and everybody waits for toast here. Because, you know, how many times, I'm sure we all recognize those movements and moments within us that seem to be wrong, that seem to be not okay to experience, that seem to be somehow not allowed by some strange internal decisions we've made about what's an acceptable thing to feel and what isn't. There are no wrong things to feel. There are plenty of things that we wouldn't want to act out, but there's nothing we shouldn't feel. There's no experience we shouldn't have. There's nothing that shouldn't arise in our minds, our hearts. What a relief. What a relief. if we could really get that, if we could really not just take that in, but if we could really be awake to that truth when difficult experience arises, when something arises in heart or mind that presents itself as in some way unacceptable, my goodness, that would relieve our souls. If you'd like a mantra for your spiritual practice, I would suggest that as one. There's nothing I shouldn't feel. It's important, of course, not to confuse that with the way it gets expressed. Right? The way it gets expressed to others. Plenty of things that we would be, you know, that can be hurtful in their expression. Few words that the impact of which can reverberate through people's lives for years, in just the same way that we may have memories of a few harsh words spoken to us at some time, the impact of which in us may have reverberated for years. So it's really important to take care with the expression of those things. But what we find is, if we're trying to suppress the inner movements, or deny the inner movements, or somehow think that they're wrong and need to be buried, then those things tend to kind of leak out in other ways. So, in this reflection on committing to presence, in including what's here, is a suggestion or an encouragement to turn towards what seems difficult, rather than away from it. It takes so much energy and a lurking background sense of wrongness and shamefulness to keep down these things, to keep away these things, to hide the kind of dark secret of all these, what a weirdo I am inside, hiding them from myself, hiding them from others. And it's an extraordinary liberation, a freedom, to be willing to include them. Not only a freedom from the pushing down and the hiding and the pain and shame of that, but a freedom because when we allow ourselves to experience that which is anyway moving inside us, it opens up. It transforms. In the example I was giving, from impatience to dynamic, alive passion for being here. Well, this practicing in this way is in some ways a tantric practice in many ways. I know people get either very alarmed or very excited when they hear tantric practice with all the extra connotations that it has. But the origins of the word tantra and of the tantric traditions is a kind of alchemical process of transmuting whatever's there rather than avoiding the difficult, rather than trying to become spiritual and become peaceful and become kind. Not to deny the beauty and importance of those things, but actually wisdom, kindness, compassion, peaceful abiding, they're the natural fruits, the natural expression of our being when we're not colluding with ourselves in hiding from ourselves, in denying what's actually happening with us. To let in what's here, to turn towards what's actually and anyway moving within us, is to let it free itself up. And the more of our being that gets freed up to move, the more natural access we have to a wise response to life, a compassionate response, a peaceful response. So I would say, let wisdom and compassion take care of themselves. We're not very good at faking it anyway. And rather to turn towards what seems difficult, so that it can get opened up and transformed. And if our practice here today and our reflections here today and our application of those in our lives is in the service of that opening up and that transformation, then it's time we'll have spent very well here together.